Call to order this hearing of the Minnesota Senate Taxes Committee, Wednesday, March 13th, at 8:34 a.m. The first item on the agenda is adoption of the minutes. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 3670, Senator Umu Verbatim. Welcome to the committee. Good morning, Senator. I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
On behalf of the author, Senator Klein moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Umu Verbatim, if you would please now take us through what looks like a very complicated bill, but the effect of it is fairly straightforward. But we need to have you take us through the bill section by section.
Yes, happy to. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just high level before I go through the section by section walkthrough, Senate File 3670 is repealing the illegal cannabis and controlled substance tax, which is Chapter 297D, but there's a number of references to other statutes that show up in the bill. So I can start by walking through that section by section and then sort of talking about the importance of this bill and why I'm bringing it forward. The first section is referencing 609 is our criminal code. And then section 609 at 902 subdivision 4 has a series of criminal acts relating to controlled substances. So it just strikes 297D09. That's on line 1.12. You'll see that strike through. And that's getting rid of the criminal penalty for the failure to pay the legal cannabis and controlled substance tax. And then my author's amendment got rid of section 2 entirely because it was a reference to 609A, which is like all of the expungement statutes. And so if we striked 297D, again, the substance, the penalty to fail, for failing to pay that illegal cannabis and controlled substance tax, then it would essentially remove the ability of folks previously charged with the crime to get their records expunged, which I don't want to do. Those folks who were previously charged should remain eligible for expungement. So that's why this section is removed. And then we go to, on the current bill, what's listed as section 3, but with the amendment, it would be reordered. And then that is just the repealer of all of the, all of 297D, so the illegal cannabis and controlled substance tax, and some references to it in other statutes. And then you'll see what those are in the appendix. Can go through those as well. So it starts with 13.4967 subdivision 5. Anything in chapter 13 is going to be data practices. So this specific section is about tax data. And then it just, the current statute clarifies that the illegal cannabis and controlled substance tax is actually governed by 297D. And that's why it would no longer need to be there because my bill would be repealing 297D in its entirety. And then we move into all the different sections within 297D, so the illegal cannabis and controlled substance tax, The first piece, 297D.01, is just definition. So what is illegal cannabis? Because we legalized cannabis, only things like possessing more than 2 pounds of cannabis flower at a private residence is considered illegal cannabis. And then it defines what all the other controlled substances are that would be subject to this tax. It defines the Commissioner of Revenue and then any person who would be subject to this tax. Then it goes into administration, just giving the commissioner administration over the chapter. That's 297D.02. 297D.03 is rules. So just giving the commissioner authority to adopt rules for the chapter. 297D.04 is tax payment required for possession. So the requirement for folks to purchase stamps for illegal cannabis or controlled substances. 297D.05 clarifies that nothing in this chapter provides folks with immunity. The 297D.06 pharmaceuticals says that nothing in this chapter requires folks who are lawfully in possession of illegal cannabis or controlled substances for paying the tax. 297D.07 is basically defining how the illegal cannabis and controlled substances are weighed for purposes of purchasing the stamps. 297D.09 is the actual tax rate for the illegal cannabis and controlled substances, which is by gram and 10 dosage units. 297D.085 talks about credit for previously paying taxes. So if you were to pay taxes on this in another state, and then you'd need to pay the difference here. 297D.09 is the actual penalties. So it establishes the criminal penalty for possessing illegal cannabis or controlled substance without the appropriate stamp, or in other words, a criminal penalty for just failure to pay the tax. The current statute of limitations is 6 years. 297D.10 is the stamp price. So just saying that official stamps come from the commissioner and then purchasers must pay 100% of the face value for each stamp. 297D.11 details how to actually affix the stamps when they're purchased. And then it clarifies taxes on illegal cannabis and controlled substances are due immediately upon possession. 297D.12 is the assessment of an alleged tax deficiency. It gives the commissioner authority to demand the payment of the taxes, establishes the standard of proof for the taxpayer. And then lastly, 297D.13 just prohibits the disclosure of the confidential nature of this information. So kind of talking through when stamps can or cannot be used for criminal proceedings, establishes those penalties if someone were to disclose, and then clarifies that the commissioner can still publish statistics on the tax. So those are all the things that are being repealed. And then back to the overall bill, which seems like a lot, but it's really just repealing the tax itself and then the criminal penalties for the tax because it's currently a felony. So the way that it currently works for folks to comply with the law, they need to purchase stamps for illegal drugs from the Department of Revenue, and the rates are 3.5 per gram for illegal cannabis, $200 per gram for controlled substances, so like all other drugs, and then $400 per 10 dosage units for a controlled substance not sold by weight. Lots of money. However, we're not actually getting any revenue from this right now. The tax was implemented in 1986, so sort of like during the height of the war on drugs. My understanding is prosecutors sort of used that as an enforcement tool previously, so they could charge folks with possession and charge them with the failure to pay taxes on their drugs. But it's just not really the practice of most prosecutors in our state anymore. I did reach out to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. They're aware of the bill. They're not taking an official position on it. Like I said, the Department of Revenue hasn't received revenue from this tax in years. The most recent data from 2019 and 2020 actually show $0 in revenue. The effort to repeal this tax chapter 2970 is also bipartisan, and it was included in House File 4667 from two sessions ago. I'm proud to have bipartisan support on the bill before you today, but would just say I think it's important for us to get rid of this, considering that we're not bringing in revenue, but it still opens folks up to potential felonies. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I would point out to members the handouts that have been provided. I don't know if you'd like to go through them, or I just want to mention them. Maybe I can do that on your behalf. There are the pictures of the stamps that the Department of Revenue can issue, I guess. There is a document that starts controlled substances tax. I'm assuming all of these have been provided by Senator Mover Baton. Her name's not on them, but that's not necessary in committee, showing the last 2 years and what the tax is. I had received, I believe, a memo that showed the taxes collected ever since the law was passed in 1986, and there were a couple of years where they did, but or a few more than a couple, but a few years where they did, but mostly they did not. We do have a revenue estimate, Senator. Maybe you'd like to explain that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Department of Revenue just provided that. Again, their fund impact is really zero for fiscal year 2024. And I think that's negligible for 25 and 26. I'm seeing like $5 for 26 and, $5,000 for 26 and 2025. I think that's because they're required to, I might want to ask Department of Revenue to speak to that, but I think there's a requirement to forecast for it, even though they know they're not bringing mm-hmm. any money in.
we can I'll point out that the A2 amendment refers to an effective date, if my suggestion, Senator Mover Baton changed it from the day after enactment to August 1st, which is when a lot of other laws go into effect. So we have some senator questions. I'm going to ask first. Senator Port has a bill in front of the Commerce Committee from the, whatever they call themselves, the Cannabis Management Office, that has a lot of the first 45. I actually read it. First 45 to 50 pages has mostly corrections, technical corrections related to medical cannabis. And then the rest sets up the licensing, or proposes at least to set up the licensing structure. I don't know if you're familiar yet with that bill. I think its first hearing is today in Commerce. But just in general, are you aware of anything in your bill that would be contradictory in policy to what is in Senator Port's bill? And if you haven't looked at it, I think probably most people haven't. But it might be something that when this bill is proposed to go to judiciary, that you take a look at that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I think the changes last year were that needed to be made to the tax as it currently operates is to define what illegal cannabis is versus legal cannabis because we legalized it. Since this would just be like repealing the tax in its entirety for any substances, there really shouldn't be any impact. They might need to reference this. I'm not sure what all of their corrections are in their bill, so there may be some references to 297D. But if we're just repealing, we decide to move forward with repealing this tax, then there shouldn't be any conflicts. It's just sort of a matter of making sure the statutes are accurately, you know, reflected.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. Senator Klein has a question.
Thank you, Chair and Senator Mover-Baton. And I can actually first speak to your question about the bill that Senator Port has in front of the Commerce Committee, and that is a department bill. Obviously, the new Department of Office of Cannabis Management came forward with some technical language this year as they try to get this program up and running. Larger than most technical bills because, of course, it's a new program. And Senator Port has agreed to carry that bill this year. I think it would be reasonable to check with their legislative liaison, Sophie Leininger, at some point and just make sure that your current bill in front of the Taxes Committee works with them. But like you, I can't imagine that it would be contradictory or in conflict. The question I had was I sort of addressed by Chair Rest. I find it fascinating that at any point in history, somebody actually purchased one of these, went to the Department of Revenue and said, I've got some illegal substances. Can I pay the tax on them? Can you give me a sticker? It would be good to have one of these stamps as like a collector's item or a memento or something. But in any case, I guess, is that the case that somebody actually went, came forward and bought a stamp, I guess? So.
There you go.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to Senator, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Barton to come forward and give us some information. I understand she's here. Welcome to the committee. If you did identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Martha Burton, and I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Revenue.
So I think you've heard the discussion about how much the tax has been collected and what that is, and you're going to lose, if this is enacted, $5,000 a year in revenue. But we would just welcome your general comments about the proposal and the effect on the Department of Revenue and its activities.
Of course, I'm happy to. The Department of Revenue does not have a position on this bill. And in the broader context of this bill, this is, in current times, a rarely used statute. As we've seen the discussion, it does not generate a significant amount of revenue. That revenue is generated when it is used as part of a successful conviction, and then that revenue comes in, which explains the $5,000 in the forecast. It's simply thinking that there may potentially be a future conviction in a case, but we can't predict if and when that would be used. In the Criminal Investigation Division of the Department of Revenue, this statute has been rarely used. In fact, last year it was not used at all. Historically, The department has pursued this charge when an external law enforcement agency has contacted the Department of Revenue to assist with adding the charge per the request of the county attorney. So this is not a statute that revenue typically uses independently. It's typically done in partnership with law enforcement. And as previous discussion noted, it's rarely used in prosecutions. And all states that have legalized recreational cannabis have also had to address the issue of black market cannabis. And this current statute is a tool in the toolbox of the Department of Revenue to assist in combating the illegal cannabis market. And it also potentially helps the legal recreational cannabis market in not allowing illicit players to have an economic or tax incentive when the black market cannabis market is competing against legal and legitimate cannabis industries.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Senator, why did you include both the other Schedule I drugs in this bill if the main purpose was, or at least the most popular purpose at this point, is taking the tax off of cannabis, illegal cannabis? Why not just do cannabis now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think because of the way this operates, it's just folks are, I don't see the incentive folks have to go to the Department of Revenue and purchase stamps on any substances, whether it's the illegal cannabis or any controlled substance. I think a lot of folks find that sort of self-incriminating. And I know that there's a lot within 297D that talks about how this operates, but it just, we can see in the decades since this tax has existed that very few folks are going on their own to purchase these stamps. It's really a tool that's used to slap on a felony for a failure to pay the tax. And I don't find that to be fair. I think we have the possession penalties that exist. And I don't think there should be a penalty for the failure to pay taxes on those illegal substances.
Senator, did you consider for those offenses that were only about the tax expungement?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing the last part of your question. Can you repeat it?
There's no reference in your bill to expungement for failure to pay or whatever these taxes. If that was the only thing that someone was being charged with, did you consider that? And if so, why didn't you not include it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There is the references to 297D do exist in that expungement statute in 609A that I referenced, right? So that's why we got rid of section 2. I think it's important to remove that penalty moving forward in addition to giving folks who were previously charged expungement. So I'm looking at moving forward and that retroactive piece.
Thank you. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the department. I think it's safe to say that we're moving into uncharted territory insofar as the marijuana legislation that was passed last year. And when there was a discussion or a comment made about, you know, the black market marijuana and the legal marijuana, and quite frankly, has the department visited with departments of revenue from other states who have had a history with legalization of marijuana to find out as to whether there was an increase actually in the tax collection because of being able to prosecute black market marijuana, because I believe we're going to see an increase in that market as well as the market of legal marijuana, because those things always follow one another. And I would like to ask the assistant commissioner if they've checked with other departments to pursue that issue and gain knowledge on that matter.
Commissioner Burton.
Thank you. The department has consulted with other states in our development of guidance and recommendations and estimates, and the revenue forecast or the revenue estimate that's provided does reflect that piece. It also factors in the how the department has seen requests from local law enforcement in terms of applying the statute, and that trend is gradually decreasing.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion or questions? The Committee on Public Safety and Judiciary has requested the bill. We will be requesting it to return to the Taxes Committee for further consideration. Senator Klein moves that Senate File 3670 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Verbaeten. The next bill on our agenda is Senate File 4552, Senator Dornick. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I'd like to, if you would explain your bill section by section, please.
Senate File, thank you, Madam Chair. 4552, this bill expands the expense eligible for K-12 credit to include expenses for qualifying child participating in a career and technical education program as defined by the bill, which specifically are three areas. The amounts paid to others for transportation outside of the regular school hours that is directly related to the career technical education program. Number two, it expenses for participants in the student organization, which there's a list in the packet of that list of those qualifying organizations. And lastly, expenses for equipment not otherwise eligible for credit that is required for participation in career technical education. So last year, this committee expanded the power.
Senator Dornick, now would be the time to go through the bill.
Pardon me?
Now would be the time to, after that introduction, to go through the bill section by section, if you would. It's not very long.
I was going to, basically what it does, I kind of did that. It just brings
Section one is definitions, and it is the first section defines what a career and technical education program is. I think it's important to in your explanation that you refer, that's where that's coming from, that's what you mean by it. And then going on to number four in line starting with 210, it defines what education-related expenses are and what it's going to include. And then there are further definitions that are in this bill. That's the kind of explanation we need, as well as the overview of what the goal of your bill is, in case members have a question of exactly what expenses starting on line 219, what expenses are going to be covered for a qualifying child who has also been defined? Okay, I guess I helped you out there in going through it, but that, but if you have a bill that comes back here to taxes, that's what we like to have pointed out to us. Not only the goals and the good purposes of your bill, but the explicit language that accomplishes that and how it happens.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now please continue.
So Senate File 4552, so last year the committee expanded the powers of Minnesota K-12 education tax credit to help address the credit loss in purchasing power. Senate File 4552 would amend the K-12 credit by making certain career technical education CTE expenses eligible for the tax credit. Our communities and employees at large need more skilled labor, yet too frequently roadblocked in the way of students getting training they want. Presently, when students take CTE courses and their instruction happens outside of the regular school building and school day, say for instance a welding course that is taught using the local business and community college facilities and equipment, low-income students can face transportation challenges. Just like when low-income CTE students participate in an organization like FFA or Skilled USA or the list that I have that's printed out here, others activities. So Senate File 452 would allow the parents of such students to claim the income tax credit of 75% of the CTE-related cost the students has incurred, up to $1,500. And so CTE is an excellent investment. With that, I'd like to have my testifier, Troy Haugen, give more details and the experiences he has had with this program.
Certainly. We would welcome Mr. Haugen. And I believe he's testifying on Zoom.
We sent him the link this morning and he hasn't joined.
Senator Dornick, we sent Mr. Haugen. Mr. Berggren sent him the link this morning and he has not responded.
Whoops.
Which is just fine, okay? That sometimes happens. We'll see if we can get that link. Meanwhile, maybe we can take a look at, or that he can come on with that link. you can take a look at, and I hope you have it in front of you, the revenue estimate for this bill. When is the effective date for your bill? I think if you look on page 3, line 12, you
December,
will see it.
Well, it has the, Madam Chair.
Yes?
After December 31st, 2023, so I would say it's after passage, I guess.
If you look at page 3, line 12, the effective date is for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2023, which means it's effective for taxable year 2024. Okay, so it will be effective beginning this year for parents to claim it on their 2024 tax return that they would file in 2025. Do you have the revenue estimate in front of you?
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you would like to kind of go through that. For us, and I think in particular, we're interested in kind of getting on the record just how much this is worth to an individual family.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in fiscal year 2025, it'll be $1.8 million and following 26 and 27. So this is a tax credit, so it's actually staying in the family's budget. So it's not, that's what we want to do is keep it in the families to be able to choose and have a benefit to get more students in CTE, because we are in a labor shortage of the career and technical. We need more workers there.
Senator Dornick, the revenue estimate does reflect, I think last year we increased the I believe it was last year, the level of income that would be eligible. It had been at a very low amount for a number of years, and we raised that ceiling last year. And in maybe more importantly, it's adjusted for inflation. What is not on the revenue estimate that I see is whether it is a refundable credit or a non-refundable credit. Senator Dornick, do you know? If not, I'll ask counsel. Counsel, Ms. Pollack, is it refundable or non-refundable?
Madam Chair, members, yes, the K-12 credit is refundable. And so this, which would be adding some provisions to that credit, these would also be refundable.
And Senator Dornick, when we're proposing things that are credits, we always like them to be refundable, because that means that even if you don't have any tax liability on your income tax return, you still get this credit. Non-refundable credits just reduce the amount of your taxes down to zero, but not below that. And if you look at the fourth dot below, it amounts to about, according to the revenue estimate, about $173 per child in 2023, which can easily make a significant contribution to the kind of programs costs that you're proposing be covered by it. So I think I have a favorable opinion of it, I'll put it that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did hear that Trihaugen is now available online, testifier. Madam Chair, the testifier is linked in now.
Is now? Yes. Okay, wonderful. So, see, we dragged that out until
you,
we got
Chair.
On, so that's just fine. And I would like to welcome Mr. Haugen to our committee, and Senator Dornick, I congratulate you for including a member of the other party as one of your co-authors. That's what gets you in this committee, bipartisan authorship.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Haugen, if you are on Zoom, if you would identify yourself for the record, we'll be pleased to have your testimony.
Good morning, everyone, Chair Rest, Senator Dornick, and members of the committee. My name is Troy Haugen. I am the Director of Career and College Readiness at Lakes Country Service Cooperative in Fergus Falls, and I also currently serve as the President of Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Administrators, or MACTA, which represent career and technical education administrators across Minnesota. Thank you for the ability to speak to you briefly today in support of Senate File 4552. Career and technical education programs run the gamut of cosmetology to public safety, to culinary, to construction, to medical, to agriculture, to early childhood, to manufacturing, to creative design, to business, to human services, to automotive, and far beyond. In short, nearly everything you depended on this morning to get here in some way, shape, or form somehow originated in a secondary CTE program. Ultimately, not only do our CTE programs fill the needs of our workforce and keep our economy strong, they're the programs that keep many of our secondary CTE students in high school. They are the programs that many of our CTE students find belonging and relevance. Many secondary CTE students leave high school with industry-recognized credentials and actual work-based learning experiences. CTE programs have incredible teachers that have strong industry connections and oftentimes bring industry experience and relevance to students. CTE programs fulfill the needs of some of the most brilliant students in our schools, sometimes students who struggle to find success and relevance in other places. Members, if I can draw your attention to the CTE in Minnesota handout, specifically noting the graduation rates and employment rates for our CTE students engaged in CTE programs in Minnesota. Career and technical student organizations, also referred to as CTSOs, are student-led organizations in middle schools, high schools, and post-secondary institutions that focus on specific career and technical CTE areas. These organizations provide students within school and oftentimes outside of the school day opportunities to develop leadership skills, explore career pathways, and apply academic and technical skills in real-world settings. CTSOs offer a range of activities such as competitions, community service projects, leadership development activities, industry partnerships. Each CTSO is aligned with a specific career cluster or industry sector, such as health sciences, business, technology, agriculture, or skilled trades. The recognized CTSOs in Minnesota include FFA, BPA, DECA, SkillsUSA, FCCLA, and HOSA. Again, members, I can draw your attention to the Minnesota Foundation for Student Organizations handouts in your packets, which also show you the depth of experiences Minnesota students have available to them. We all likely understand and support the significance of accessing programs and facilities beyond the regular school hours. These opportunities are often crucial for students to gain hands-on experiences and practical skills that can prepare them for their future careers. However, it can be challenging when these activities require students and families to incur personal costs, such as transportation expenses. Additionally, participation in student organizations can incur personal costs as well, such as membership fees or travel expenses for competitions or conferences. It's important for schools and policymakers to recognize these financial burdens on students and their families and working towards a more positive and positive support and resources that include for all students to have equal access to these valuable opportunities. Simplest example I can share with you is a scenario that happens very frequently is travel to competitions outside of the school day for CTSOs. I was actually speaking with one of my teachers that I work with last night who happens to be a SkillsUSA advisor. He has had several students each year advance to state, regional, and national competitions where the travel cost itself has become incredibly burdensome to families. Your support in providing the ability to include education-related travel expenses related to CTE programs as an eligible income tax credit is incredibly helpful to parents and families and much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Halgan. I think we really do need to pay attention to this credit is available not to the students, but to their families, to their parents. And even if they're enrolled in a, as I understand it, a post-secondary program or one of these organizations that are listed in one of your handouts, they still have to be a 12th. The credit is only available to the families of students who are at E through 12. And so if a student who, even though he or she may remain a dependent, has graduated from high school, that's not an eligible expense for their parents. You have to still be in the E-12 system, just to clear that up. Are there any questions or comments for either Mr. Halgan or for Senator Dornick? And I think I would just point out that the handouts that you've provided are very informative and very impressive of the work that's being done by these organizations and programs for training the workforce. Anyone else have a comment or question? Seeing none without objection, Senate File 4552 will be laid over. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Our next bill is Senate File 4216, Senator Weber. Senator Weber brings us Senate File 4216, dealing with property taxes. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 4216, if you go to the bill, it only has one paragraph that basically produces a change. But I want to point out that on the first page, Subdivision 2 talks about exempt properties. Any exempt real estate or personal property that is owned by a nonprofit entity, for example, does tend to generate a tax on that property if it is used for any type of profitable purpose by another entity. And if you go to subsection B under subdivision 2, you'll start to see a list of those properties that have been exempted from property tax as a result of some type of activity. I think one of the more recent ones we had in front of our committee was the Duluth Airport hangars that last year that were discussed. And the purpose of my bill adds an item number 7 on page 2 of the bill. And item 7 says that property owned by a nonprofit conservation organization that is leased, loaned, or otherwise made available to a private individual, corporation, or association for grazing activities that further the nonprofit conservation organization's conservation objectives for the property. And what this really boils down to is that in one of my counties, as well as different areas across the state, we do have large areas of grazing land that are owned, in the case and the testifier that is with me today, by the Nature Conservancy. And at this point in time, they do not lease those acres out. The Nature Conservancy actually owns two types of property. Some are tax exempt, some are not. And the tax exempt properties are not leased out because of the fact that it generates this particular tax. And when you have needs in the community, particularly by our farmers and ranchers, for additional grazing acres, and in the case of Lincoln County and my district, they've had 2 years of drought, which has greatly reduced the capability of the pastures, it is important to have another source for grazing opportunities. And even though there might be a lease arrangement that brings cash into the Nature Conservancy, the reality of it is that these pastures are not grazed for an entire year. They are only grazed for a portion of the year. Typically, your farmer rancher is going to have to do some temporary fencing, et cetera, and has a number of costs associated with bringing livestock to that particular area. And so the amount of rent that could be charged is going to be minimal at best. And then as you go through and finish out the bill, this would be effective for property taxes payable in the year 2025. And if you look at the information from the department as far as a revenue estimate, it indicates it's negligible because we're dealing obviously with farmland real estate taxes in this scenario. It mentions something about a shift. However, if this property does not receive an exemption, there's not going to be anything to shift because they do not pay any real estate tax now. And with that, Madam Chair, I have with me today Mr. Stephen Chaplin from the Nature Conservancy, who would have some further comments regarding this issue.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Before I call on Mr. Chaplin, I would also note that in the revenue estimate, they indicate the property tax shift, but it would only increase homeowner property tax refunds for those on whom it is shifted by $5,000 in 2026. So it is in general, a negligible property tax shift at that level. Welcome to the committee, sir, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Rest and committee members. My name is Steve Chaplin. I'm the Prairie Conservation Coordinator for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. The Nature Conservancy is a nonprofit organization working to protect the lands and waters on which all life depends. One of the ways we do that in Minnesota is through the protection and restoration of native prairie grasslands. Unfortunately, less than 2% of Minnesota's native prairie grasslands remain, but they have critical benefits for carbon sequestration, water quality, wildlife habitat, and endangered species conservation, among other benefits for Minnesota. Today, I'm here to speak in support of Senate File 4216, which would help TNC conduct prairie management on certain tax-exempt lands by enabling the use of cattle grazing by private ranchers as a conservation tool. Conservation grazing is an important component in maintaining the health and vigor of our state's grasslands and is widely recognized as a cost-effective tool for prairie management. Targeted conservation grazing is generally very limited in both space and duration, and when strategically employed, helps control invasive species and contributes to healthy soils and prairie restoration. One of the greatest threats to our prairies is the invasion of cool season non-native grasses, and limited duration grazing early and late in the growing season is one of the best techniques we have for maintaining invasive grasses. We have been engaged in recent years with individual cattle producers and state and federal agencies to develop plans to meet management goals and provide additional access for cattle producers to graze on public and Nature Conservancy lands. In addition to facilitating this collaboration, TNC has invested heavily in fencing and watering infrastructure on both public and TNC lands, an effort which has resulted in expanding the acres of grass available to cattle ranchers. Now, while we've made good progress with respect to public lands, current law stipulates that any time tax-exempt lands are available to a for-profit business, those lands are subject to a property tax for that year. Because conservation grazing does not occur every year, and when it does occur, it's usually of short duration, for-profit ranchers are usually unwilling to pay enough to cover the tax burdens that would result. An exemption to open these tax-exempt properties to grazing to further conservation objective enables private ranchers to graze their cattle on these tax-exempt grasslands while benefiting both the producer and the conservation organization. Senate File 4216 would enable us to conduct rotational, ecologically driven grazing on TNC parcels and provide increased forage to private cattle producers without jeopardizing our tax-exempt status. Because these lands are already tax-exempt, Senate File 4216 would be effectively revenue neutral to counties and other local units of government, and adopting this bill would provide a win-win solution for conservation and agriculture. Thank you, Senators Rest and Weber, and committee members for the opportunity to speak to you this morning, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Kaplan, I'm much more familiar with nuisance aquatic invasive species, particularly on the Great Lakes and Lake Superior, zebra mussels, et cetera, and carp in the, along the Mississippi, and we know the history of the invasion. Some invasive species are not nuisances, and they can be they can work just fine with native species. What characterizes a nuisance species, invasive species, in the grazing land, and how did those grasses get there?
So, Madam Chair, there are three predominant species that are these invasive non-season grasses: smooth brome, reed canary grass, and Kentucky bluegrass. All three of them were introduced purposefully in the past, over the last 100 years, because they are aggressive grasses that, you know, tend to be very good forage for cattle. Unfortunately, in the prairie situation, where you got mostly non-native species, because they are so aggressive, they tend to come in and take over those prairie areas. And so they, you know, take over more and more space, and at some point, all you have left are these non-native grasses rather than the native prairie grasses.
I see. Are there other questions or comments for Mr. Kaplan or Senator Weber? Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Mr. Kaplan, I don't know if I missed it in your presentation or not, but will you then be charging rent to these farmers for the grazing in response to their ability to graze the land and you not have to pay taxes?
Mr. Kaplan.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Drazkowski. We do charge rent. As a nonprofit, we're not able, you know, we're prohibited for giving away anything without consideration. And so we charge them what is, you know, basically they're willing to pay to be able to do this. Those revenues immediately get put back into the management of those same prairie areas so that there's, in essence, no net revenue, or if there is any revenue, it tends to be a very small amount.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Madam Chair. Okay.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Kaplan or Senator Weber? Then, once again, without exemption, without objection, Senate File 4216 is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
Committee.
You.
Thank you.
Senator Rest, welcome to your committee. Senate File 4115 is in front of the committee, and I think you have an author's amendment, the A1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you very much. The Senate File 4115 is a bill that addresses, as do many other proposals before the legislature over the past several years, in particular, the issue of effectively and efficiently providing housing for those with limited incomes. And that's what this bill does in four parts. Section one authorizes a political subdivision, and that can be a town, it can be a city, it can be a town, it can be a school district or a county, to provide property tax abatements this time. It's not tax increment, but an abatement for a property that is held by a land bank organization. And the next section defines, or section one actually defines what a land bank organization is. It can be a 501c3, which is a fully tax-exempt organization, or it can be a limited liability company or corporation, which a nonprofit organization is a sole member. So it's an LLC. It can be an LLC in which a 501c3 is the only member of the limited liability company. So two ways to accomplish this that are explained in section one. Section two is details the purposes for which the abatement can be given on lines 219, 220, 221, that it provides for the development, again, of affordable housing, and at this, and it's at a certain level, and that is 80% of the AMI. And then it also will allow the property to be held by the land bank organization, that is the 501c3, for future development. The abatement, however, is a limited of limited duration and is only good for 5 years. And the resolution, even if a resolution by a local government does not specify a time, it is assumed and limited to five years. And the local government, whichever one of the four or five that is eligible, is does indeed need to pass a resolution. But even if the resolution does not specify the length of time, it is limited to 5 years. Over in the other body, when the bill was taken up, there was an amendment offered by Representative Quam, who's a very thoughtful member of the House Taxes Committee, that provided a clawback provision, which we have done in the past for any number of entities where they don't, for whatever reasons, they fail to make good on whatever the program is. And that was the amendment that we added here, so which says that the land bank organization has to repay the abatement with interest if the land for which the abatement was granted is used for a purpose other than which the abatement was granted. So you can't get it for one thing and then do a bait and switch and go and do it for something else. And if it's used for another purpose, this provision in the amendment applies immediately, and the land is subject to repayment for the same number of years that the abatement was granted. So if it was granted for 3 years, whatever the amount of that abatement with interest was granted, the land bank organization needs to repay that amount of money with interest. And I'm sorry, I don't have a statute book, but Ms. Pollack can tell us what 270C-40 subdivision 5 is for what the interest can be imposed. Mr. Sylvia, I believe Mr. Chairman has that number.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest and members, so it is linked to the prime rate charged by banks. I'm looking at the department's website, and it has kind of fluctuated, but it's typically between 5% and 8%.
Senator okay. Rest.
And I would draw your attention also to the revenue estimate. The revenue estimate does show in the starting in fiscal year 26 that there is a savings or a cost, depending on how you look at it, of $10,000, and I believe they explain that in the description of the on the revenue estimate. Even though there, and this happens sometimes, and sometimes we don't like it, and sometimes it's the only way to get something done. There's only one land bank organization in Minnesota, as I understand it. And so even though they are not named in the bill currently, and maybe there will be others, but currently they are the only one that would be eligible for it. And that, in the name of transparency, they are identified in the revenue analysis detailed. The cost, if you look at the fifth bullet point, is about $500,000 in property taxes that would be in 2024 that would be potentially eligible for an abatement other, under this proposal. Mr. Chairman and members, that is the explanation of the bill, and I believe Mr. Streitz, who is an official with the Land Bank Twin Cities, is here to testify.
Mr. Streitz, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you, Chair Rest. Thanks for having me, and I also want to thank our other Senate authors, Senators Dibble, France, and Weber. Thank you for being authors on this bill. I'm Tom Streitz, president and co-founder of the Land Bank Twin Cities. I founded the Land Bank in 2009 during the height of the foreclosure crisis as I watched hundreds of low-income homeowners lose their life savings and their homeownership dreams as a result of predatory lending to large multinational corporations that had no connection or long-term interest in the community. The inspiration for the Land Bank was simple: to create a locally owned and controlled financial partner to benefit low-income families with long-term community benefit in mind. Since our founding, the Land Bank has been a force for good in our community, as evidenced in the charts in front of you. You can see the return to the taxing jurisdiction when we purchase a property is astronomical. We take vacant, foreclosed, otherwise not used land, and we put it back into productive use, and has a huge benefit for the taxpayers in that community, as you can see. We've created thousands of rental units and assisted hundreds, if not thousands, of families become first-time homeowners. We have also assisted neighborhoods in preserving historical assets, such as the Victoria Theater, and nonprofit community partners like Indigenous Roots in St. Paul. And finally, we've assisted a group of low-income Latino families buy their rental buildings from a slumlord and soon to become owners of the buildings and operate them as a co-op. So I want to just finish by saying simply why this should be considered for passage today. Three reasons. All savings realized by abatement will flow directly to the end users in the form of lower rents, more affordable mortgages, and lower interest rates. Any taxes temporarily forgiven, as the charts in front of you demonstrate, result in an enormous increase in tax revenues in the end for the communities and counties in which the Land Bank operates. And finally, this is not a mandate, but an option. For those counties that want a unique and flexible community development tool in their toolkit, they can opt in. Finally, can you imagine a locally owned and operated bank in your community where you can pick up the phone, talk to a real person, and find a partner willing to take risks to help you achieve your goals and dreams? I did, and I call it the Land Bank Twin Cities. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Streitz. Member questions or comments on the bill? Seeing none, Senate file 4115 as amended will be laid over. Senator Rest?
Thank you very much. I feel like I've hit a home run here. So thank you very much. And Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
The Taxes Committee is adjourned.